What are the cognitive impacts of psychotic disorders in youth? We spoke with Dr. Ian Ramsey, clinical psychologist at the University of Minnesota. His lab studies aspects of neuroplasticity in people with serious mental illnesses, and his findings are a big help to those of us working with young patients in school. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast. This is a special episode from the Child Psychiatry team. I'm Dr. Josh Fader, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report and co-author of the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice.
And I'm Mara Governman, a licensed clinical social worker in Southern California with a private practice. I'm also a regional director at Real Connections Child Development Institute.
When we think about psychosis, we think about hallucinations and delusions. There are also big effects on cognition we need to consider. People with psychosis experience global cognitive deficits across most domains of cognition that we measure, such as working memory and attention, long-term memory, problem solving, processing speed, and cognitive control.
One of the big questions I have is about how these impacts affect function at school, in social settings, and in treatment efforts.
So we went to the research team at the University of Minnesota and talked to Dr. Ramsey.
So in young people especially, school is one of the first places where we actually notice some of these problems. And we actually have a lot of work out in the community as well, where we try to train teachers and other staff members in schools to kind of identify these early signs of what we call the prodrome. And these are a series of symptoms that characterize a pre-onset of a psychosis. And one of the most hallmark symptoms that we observe in the prodrome is this decline in academic functioning, which is something that we observe pretty consistently, such that a student who seemed to have been doing just fine, say in high school or early on in college, very suddenly shows a rapid decline in their academic functioning. And some of this is related to the cognitive problems, but it can also be related to some of the other symptoms that they could be experiencing, such as delusional ideation or auditory hallucinations, as well as just becoming more disorganized.
Even kids who don't have any kind of psychotic disorder need good sleep and nutrition to succeed at school. Imagine the effects of experiencing psychosis and everything that does to sleep added on to trying to handle school.
Then add social pressure to that.
A lot of the patients that we see describe a period of time where they begin to isolate, often a period of time after they've maybe gotten treatment that they're having trouble socializing the way that they used to, whether that's being able to kind of track a conversation, whether it's being able to kind of understand people's intentions. We've got a lot of research suggesting that the ability to track and understand facial emotions or intonations and prosody are impaired in people with psychosis, such that, you know, you could imagine if you're having trouble with, say, you know, your attention and working memory, and we're also having trouble understanding the intonation of somebody's voice, it would make it very challenging to interact socially. And that is one of the primary reasons why we see these deficits. We don't have treatments per se that specifically target these things pharmacologically, so it becomes a challenge psychologically to address these.
So what can family and friends do to support patients struggling with psychosis in these academic and social situations?
Dr. Ramsey stresses family involvement.
Certainly, family support is paramount in this population. In fact, we have pretty good evidence to suggest that people's outcomes are better when they have strong, solid family support. And some of that comes down to sheer resources, you know, having a safe place to be, having someone to help you, you know, manage medications, financial support, but also it's the ability to kind of be eyes on the ground. And we learn a lot from our patients' families. I definitely think early on in the illness, we observe this lack of insight which is something that's quite perplexing. You see individuals who may have experienced a psychosis and had a stay at the hospital even, and then are continuing to kind of suffer from some of those symptoms, but are otherwise doing a little bit better, but now are feeling like they don't need support from their psychiatrists or psychologists or other therapists, and that this was all a blip and things are just fine. When we often have collateral information that things aren't going as good as they think.
As any clinician knows, this is an extremely challenging situation for patients and families. Dr. Ramsey has a theory that highlights this. He calls it the two hospitalization theory.
I have this sort of informal theory about some of this. I call it my two hospitalization theory, and it's a pretty unfortunate one because we don't like to have patients hospitalized. But what I've noticed clinically is that a number of patients require a second hospitalization before they have the insight and understanding that there is now a pattern to these symptoms that they're experiencing, and that what's happened to them was not a mistake by the doctors, and it was not because of the substances they were using, and it was not because everybody else was making it up. It's something that's really happening and is really a problem for them. And unfortunately, I think it sometimes takes more than one psychiatric episode for someone to understand that about themselves. It's not ideal. You know, it's one thing in children, but in a lot of cases, these are young adults, you know, 18 or 19 years old. And if that's the case, they can make a lot of their own decisions about their care without family member involvement. And because of that, we have to respect that. But at the same time, they're not always making decisions in their best interest.
Even after the hospitalizations, there's the medications. How do those affect cognition?
Exactly. We give people these antipsychotic pills, and with luck, their symptoms are a little bit better. But then we're in this position where the patients complain that the pills are giving them cognitive problems.
A lot of these medications do have, what we would kind of consider this anticholinergic cognitive profile. I've been doing a lot of work in the last, 10 years or so, examining whether some of these kind of computerized interventions might be able to improve aspects of people's cognition. And what we kind of know from the literature, some of the work that we've done in our lab, is that yes, we can seem to rescue some of people's cognitive abilities such that these might have downstream effects on aspects of community or educational functioning and things like that, which are pretty important in this population. That being said, we are still trying to figure out how best to personalize these types of interventions, such that we might begin to tailor a training to kind of fit the cognitive profile of of an individual patient, such that we might be able to really hone in on what someone's specific need is, and that's a challenge that our field is facing right now, is figuring out the optimal way to do that. You know, a number of years ago, we thought that the brain stopped developing after adolescence, but now we know that it's developing and changing well into adulthood. And we do know that people as old as 80 can functionally change aspects of how their brain operates, which is a very hopeful story. Adolescence and young adulthood, that is a critical period where we can kind of capitalize on some of that plasticity. And our goal is to try to harness it. Like I said, we're still in the early phases of figuring out exactly what some of that might be, but it's a primary goal.
That's a hopeful idea.
Yeah, computers to the rescue, but that's a little while off still. In the meantime, clinicians have to try tailoring cognitive interventions for their younger patients.
There's more we can do to alleviate stress. Dr. Ramsey has some ideas around employment that were really interesting too.
In our clinics, one of the, in addition to, medication management and individual therapy, we also offer what's called supported employment and education. Supported employment and education specialist works with a patient in the community to kind of identify how they can be most helpful to reintegrate someone either back into a job or help them get accommodations at school working with them to improve their social life or things like that. And what we've found is that that makes an incredible difference.
Psychosis is more than just the major symptoms we see. It has wide-ranging effects that need to be considered, monitored, and treated in conjunction with pharmacological treatments.
Think long-term. Think about stressors and work with everyone you can in your patient's circles to alleviate things negatively impacting treatment. As a clinical social worker, I think about case management and I think about how best to listen to the family, how to support them, to talk about routine and active daily living skills, being sure that we talk after hospitalization about diet and exercise and meditation and activities, and then also connecting family with additional resources and referrals so they're not doing this all by themselves. Dr. Fader has talked many years about summarizing the 3 to 5 important things on a short-term basis so that we have a clear understanding of what our short and intermediate and long-term goals are. And I think when you frame it that way, it helps break down the overwhelming feelings.
A short-term goal, an immediate goal, is often something like, you know, let's cool things down so that nobody needs to be hospitalized. And then a medium range goal is, okay, where are we in school and how do we catch up a little bit and what extra support is needed so that we can kind of stabilize that? And what are we going to tell our friends about where we were? Like, how do you manage peer relationships in the context of a recent hospitalization? And then the longer term aspects are, so how long are we going to be on these medications, and how does this impact plans for college? You know, are you going to live away? Is that going to be a problem? Or, you know, some people are already thinking about other kinds of long-term things, like, does this affect what kind of career I can have? And it does. I mean, for instance, when somebody requires an antipsychotic medication, that's usually not a situation where you want them volunteering to join the military or other kinds of jobs where you might end up in a remote place when you might need help. Even some colleges are kind of remote, and you want to be thinking about what kind of supports people are going to need or should have away at school.
You know, I'm thinking even more about nuts and bolts of giving a description of a routine that includes the sleep, hydrating. What's your backup plan if you can sleep? And many times if you are working with clients and they are part of their treatment plan, they feel empowered and they're more likely to buy into trying these other options and being sure that they understand how important it is to eat and hydrate and sleep and what kind of exercise and what are you going to do if you can't sleep. So I think that those are critical first step components that need to be discussed with family so that they walk out with some concrete game plan.
Bottom line, don't think of antipsychotics as a cure-all. Think of it as a part of a process. Like we often say, medications don't make up for the lack of an adequate plan. You really need a comprehensive plan. This is a difficult treatment area for child and adolescent clinicians. There's a lot we can improve on. If you like what you've heard, we have an upcoming issue of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report right on this topic. Hopefully people check it out. Subscribers get print issues in the mail and email notifications when new issues are available on the website. Subscriptions also come with full access to all the articles on the website and CME credits.
And everything from Carlatt Publishing is independently researched and produced. There is no funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, the newsletters and books are among the few CME publications that depend entirely on reader support. There are no ads, and our authors don't receive industry funding. That helps us bring you unbiased information you can trust. This is also something I love about the newsletters. The material we publish comes from clinicians working in the field every day, like us. So we have seen these treatments work firsthand.
Tell them about the discount.
Since you've listened this far, you can get a full subscription of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report for $30 off using the coupon code LISTENER.
Talk to you later.